Today in Studio 360, Australia's number one novelist Peter Carey will finally explain why his country is angry at the United States. You didn't know? Me neither.
Maybe none of you remember or none of you have been told what the United States did to Australia in 1975.
I'll talk with Peter Carey, whose new novel was inspired by the world's most dangerous Australian, Julian Assange. And back in the 1990s, the music from Rent became inescapable. Now Cubans are getting a chance to hear and sing Seasons of Love. It's the first Broadway show to go to Havana since the revolution. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. The best ideas always seem to strike when you're not hunting for them, when you're exercising or waiting to pick up the kids or standing online. But what happens when the pocket computer slash TVs that we call phones fill every spare moment with distraction? When are the eureka moments going to happen?
Cell phones, habits, or addiction. Tonight on Fox.
I probably check it like every 5 minutes.
How do you compare this to other addictions, let's say drugs or alcohol?
It's even more widespread, though, I think.
I'll talk with a technology journalist about why you might really need regular doses of boredom in your life. But first,
in the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries.
That was President Obama last month announcing his plans to thaw relations between the U.S. and Cuba. For more than half a century, Cuba has been a bit of a mystery to most Americans, a kind of romantic, tragic Cold War artifact. In our popular imagination, a place of very old American cars and these gorgeous decaying buildings. But that picture is about to get a lot more fleshed out. Americans are obviously about to visit Cuba in numbers unseen since the 1950s, yes, to buy cigars and hang out on beaches, but also to see and hear and consume the art and culture of this most nearby, faraway country. Victoria Burnett is a journalist who lived in Cuba for 4 years recently and writes about the country for the New York Times. She joins me now from Mexico City. Victoria, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So if you can sort of, in a general way, what kinds of cultural scenes will they find? How distinct is it? How different from the rest of Latin America, or for that matter, Florida, are the arts scenes?
One of the things I think is surprising about the Cuban cultural scene is it's very vibrant, considering Cuba is not a large country. It has a population of just over 11 million people. Havana is a city of about 4 million. And yet you have theaters, ballet, lots of galleries, artist studios, contemporary dance, and then the sort of cliched image of the Cuban, which happens to be true, which is that Cubans are very, very interested in music and dance. So you feel it on the streets. It's also extremely accessible to Cubans because one of the policies of the government has been to make culture economically accessible. So for the price of a bag of popcorn, you can go and see a movie for 5 or 6 cents. You can go to see the ballet. You can go to a concert.
As this opening happens and presumably will grow between the United States and Cuba, what will be the impact on Cuban artists? I mean, it's impossible to predict with precision, but what do you think?
I think that the immediate impact will be that their market will simply grow because there will be more Americans visiting. One of the few things you can bring back under the embargo from Cuba is an unlimited amount of art.
Really?
So one of the things that people spend really quite significant sums on when they go to Cuba is art. So they've always had this lifeline from the Americans. On the music front, it should just become easier. Less red tape, more musicians coming down, more Cuban musicians being able to go to the United States. And that's a very significant cultural connection because between New Orleans and Havana, there was a very strong jazz connection in the past, and it's something I know that there are a lot of artists who are very eager to foment as things go forward.
I would assume that literature, that fiction, that novels, because it's words and has, you know, is more potentially more threatening in its didactic take on life in Cuba and the regime, would be more problematic for writers. Is that so?
That's a very good point. I think that perhaps because books are physical things that can be passed around from person to person, there does seem to be stronger control on literature. Plus, the Cuban state owns the bookshops. So if you go into a Cuban bookshop, you're only going to find the books that they approve of. That said, the most famous Cuban novelist, Leonardo Padura, who's written detective novels and a book about Trotsky, his work is absolutely searing in its depiction of Cuba, and yet he publishes in Spain, he publishes on the island. His books are very widely read, and he still lives there. So Go figure.
Cuban artists have been known for the last 50 years, along with the rest of Cuba, for getting along with very limited resources. Assuming they now will start getting, in a significant way, better access to supplies and opportunities, what will the effect of that be?
I mean, still there are restrictions to what you can bring into the country just on a practical level. It's difficult to get stuff. It's difficult to import. So, you know, I've been asked to bring things occasionally for artist friends or others. You know, people need graphite for their drawings or ink for spotting photographs, and they can't get it. But increasingly, those materials are available, especially to those artists who travel back and forth a lot. But it's so ingrained in their kind of artistic psyche. It'll be interesting to see for how long Cubans continue to paint and use these interesting materials that they can just, that are what is on hand locally.
Developed countries, as well as less developed countries around the world for our entire lifetimes, have complained about being swamped by American movies and TV and music. Is this something that anybody in Cuba, artists in Cuba, are concerned about, the flood coming?
I mean, to be honest, I think that's something that people from outside of Cuba are concerned about happening to Cuba.
Uh-huh.
I think that a lot of people go to Cuba, and what they love about it is it's like they're stepping back in time, and there's no McDonald's, and there's no this, and there's no that.
Yeah.
I think Cubans actually kind of fancy having a McDonald's, you know, and a lot of the comforts that go with everyday life in a consumer environment. I mean, I think that this romantic vision that outsiders have of Cuba, where it's decadent and the cars are all ancient and rattle along, for Cubans, that car is a headache. They would rather just have a Honda.
Yeah. Victoria Burnett, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Victoria Burnett is a journalist who has lived in Cuba and writes about the country for the New York Times. So before the restrictions on trade with and travel to Cuba were lifted, an interesting experiment was going on in Havana. The first Broadway musical to open in Cuba since back when Camelot and Bye Bye Birdie were brand new on Broadway. The show now playing Havana? Rent, Jonathan Larson's musical pian to 1980s Bohemian New York. Reporter Marissa Neff went to see it.
I'm Marissa, and I'm obsessed with Rent. Or I was back in the day. I saw the musical on Broadway 3 times. I waited in line for the movie on opening night. I tortured my roommates.
525,600 minutes.
Like that.
525,000 moments so deep.
When Rent opened in the 90s, I was fresh out of college, carving out my life in a new city, paying rent for the first time. My friends and acquaintances seemed to like the show's characters. The hunky Roger, the nerdy and frustrated Mark, and Mimi Marquez, the damaged sex pot with the heart of gold. So I was pretty excited when I heard through the grapevine that Rent was going to open in Havana while I was there in December. Is this the first Broadway show to be staged in Cuba?
Yes, in the last 50 years, it's the first show to come directly from Broadway to Cuba.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. Everyone in the world knows the prestige of Broadway, the level of professionalism and discipline, and it's an incredible experience for us to have it here in Cuba.
That's the show's associate director, Rainier Rodriguez-Vasquez. He told me that music education and talent are huge in Cuba, but that didn't mean finding the right cast and crew was easy. I called Andy Senor Jr., the show's Cuban-American director, in Miami.
The actors didn't really know the art form too well, so I got some singers and some actors, and none of them had real proficiency with doing it in combination. And not only that, but also in this particular musical style, which is very specific. And training them in the medium and also teaching them rent was a whole job in itself.
On the night I went, the few tourists in the audience had paid $20 to get in, but most tickets went to Cubans for about 80 cents. Rent in Cuba, as I later learned from the producers, wasn't a money-making proposition. That wasn't really the point. But I had other questions. What would the Cuban audience make of Rent? Its depictions of junkies, AIDS, and landlords.
It's time to get my freak on.
For one thing, you don't see much drug use in Cuba. And in the 80s, the health ministry quarantined people with HIV. That was considered very harsh from a human rights standpoint, but it prevented an epidemic. Housing is guaranteed there. Cubans may have plenty of problems, but not the problems of New York.
We had to stay very faithful to the vision of Jonathan Larson, the creator of Rent, and respect his whole story. It couldn't be a translation based in Cuba. We kept all the social aspects, everything in the show that comes from New York.
There were only small gestures to Cubanize the play, like calling out Havana's Calle 23 in place of New York's Avenue B. I talked to Igor Vega at the premiere. He's a singer with Havana's top opera company. He told me that although Cuba's artists live rent-free, he related to Rent.
In this country, we've had to struggle at all levels of art, from independent artists to those who are associated with state institutions, which is the majority here because everything is institutionalized, but in ways that keep things controlled within certain parameters. The struggle is still for spaces to work in and for artists to be supported. So I think Rent touches this theme too.
Don't breathe too deep. Don't think all day.
For years, Cuba's Ministry of Culture and many artists have expressed anxiety about the influence of U.S. culture, especially its consumerist ethos. But the truth is, it's rare to meet Cubans who aren't fascinated by American music and TV. People pass around music videos and TV shows, these days on flash drives. Ariadna Nunez, who stars in Rent, first saw the show on a VHS tape.
15 years ago, I watched the musical for the first time, and I loved it so much I cried. But it never crossed my mind that one day I'd perform in Rent, much less play Mimi.
Nunez studied at Cuba's National School of Art, and she starred in some plays and TV shows, including a soap opera called Summer of Love. She seemed hopeful that Rent might reignite Cuba's own musical theater. You see, going back to the 19th century, locally produced musicals and operas filled Havana's grand theaters. And in the 20th century, every American star played in Havana, up until the revolution.
Cuba has a tradition of musical theater, but it's mostly in the past. So to have the chance to do a musical at a world-class level is something we're so grateful for. I think it's the start of a new era, for much more musical theater and much more cultural exchange.
Even if a few things about Rent were lost on the crowd, Larson's play is a critique of private property. And Cubans know a thing or two about the critique of private property. And as Andy Senor told me, there's really nothing more Cuban than finding ways to make do.
Cubans have a very specific way of adapting to their situation, whether economically or culturally, and they're very intensively creative around that. Very much like the characters in Rent. Yeah, and I think that's what's so great about Rent being the first show that we bring over, because it's not like it's like Beauty and the Beast, and you know they can't really identify, but these specific characters, they can.
Igor Vega, the opera singer, felt they definitely had.
Creo que no hay países más simbólicos de...
I don't think there are two countries more symbolic of separation in the world than Cuba and the United States. But if this separation could be resolved, it would be wonderful. And I think art is the way. I hope this is the first step of many.
For Studio 360, I'm Marissa Neff.
And at Studio360.org, you can see a video of the Havana cast of Rent in rehearsal. Coming up. Not so long ago, the novelist Peter Carey's publisher made an unusual proposition. Did he want to ghostwrite the autobiography of Julian Assange? Interesting, but no.
If you're the victim of a biography, everything you're doing is trying to have control. And if you're a novelist, you want to be in control all the time.
My conversation with Peter Carey ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Every year, we ask you to send us your New Year's resolutions, the ones for creative projects that you need a bit of tough love to get off the ground. We pick four of you to follow all year long and hold you to your resolutions. We heard from lots and lots of you, including Maria Thornton from Yellow Springs, Ohio, who is with me now on the line. Hello, Maria.
Hi there. Greetings. Good morning.
Your New Year's resolution, what is it?
To do more reggae DJing, in a nutshell. I'm a 46-year-old mother of three, and I've done a little college radio and things, but I really decided now is the time to push that. The world needs more positivity.
So you were a teenager in the 80s.
Right.
Is that when you got into reggae?
Yes. When MTV was brand new, there was a song on there that absolutely changed my life. I was 12 or 13 years old. And this tune was on, Pas de Dutchie on the left hand side. And I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what that music was, but I would go running to the TV to hear it, turn it up. I went to college here in Ohio for 2 years at Wright State, and I just was drawn to the music, and I literally transplanted myself to St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands to soak up the music and culture.
Really?
I mean,
well, we found a recording of you performing in the song Work Together by Ross Chagai.
Awesome. We've got to stay.
So you were just what, listening to a reggae radio station on Pandora, and suddenly there that song was?
Yeah, right. And my daughter, who was home from college at the time, I was like, Maya, I'm on the Pandora. She was like, that's great, Mom. Pandora, yes, good stuff. I'm like, no, it's me. I mean, I'm really singing on the Pandora. So, yeah, that actually reminded me, you know, I should be doing more of this. And I've got the sound system, but I feel like I'm a little bit of a dinosaur DJ these days. Everybody's got all this mixing equipment. And, you know, when I was DJing in college, I was mixing with two CD decks, you know, and one turntable. And so I feel like I need to hone up on my skills and see what people are. I've been watching a couple of YouTube instructionals, see people are out there doing all kinds of stuff these days.
Or you could make the whole OGA thing your thing. You could be very old school, you know?
Right, true that. I could go a little old school with it, you know. So, I mean, ultimately my goals are to do more local DJing, do more local singing and chanting with local artists, benefit summer festivals. In fact, our town has a great ball drop at the end of the year, and so I'm already kind of planning for a reggae party in the street on New Year's Eve, Yellow Springs, Ohio.
That's a good goal for this year-long thing. Now, your day job is what? What do you do for a living?
I am an artist. I paint church murals, and I clean houses for a living here in Yellow Springs.
Huh.
And I'm helping others and close to my kids and seeing results quickly, so I'm happy with my work.
Excellent.
I love what I do, but one friend said to me, you know, Maria, you are an artist, and you are not serving humanity by scrubbing toilets. And I said, but oh, I am. Anything I do is serving humanity if I'm doing it with my heart. But, you know, there is a point to it that I have a voice and that the world needs more love and positivity more than ever, you know. So thank you all for giving me the opportunity to push myself. I think sometimes a good idea and a deadline can create real genius.
Well, Maria, thank you. And we will be back in touch again and again.
You are welcome. And thank you, too. And I look forward to talking to you all in the next moment.
Great. See ya.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you. Peace.
I'll be talking with the rest of our 2015 Creative Resolution makers in the weeks to come. The Booker Prize is pretty much the biggest award for a novel in English. And when Peter Carey first won the Booker for the best-selling Oscar and Lucinda, he was still holding down a day job as an advertising executive, which was pretty much the end of that day job. He's best known for his historical novels, like Oscar and Lucinda, and The True History of the Kelly Gang, about a real-life Australian outlaw. But his latest book, set right now, could not be timelier, with a plot about government surveillance and a spectacular act of global cyber militants. It's called Amnesia, and Peter Carey is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
So Amnesia is about an indicted anti-government hacker from Australia, which makes me think, were you inspired by the real-life indicted Australian anti-government hacker Julian Assange?
Well, he set me thinking, certainly. And, you know, he's Australian. I'm Australian. I was in New York.
He's got white hair. You've got white hair.
His is whiter than mine. Anyway, I'm sitting here and I'm listening to the news and I'm listening to politicians calling him a traitor. You know, this is not an American citizen. He cannot possibly be a traitor.
To the West, to truth, to right.
To everything that's true. And I was thinking, well, you can be self-righteous about what he's doing, but maybe none of you remember or none of you have been told what the United States did to Australia in 1975. So if Mr. Assange is getting a bit pissy with you, maybe he has some reasons for that. Now, that's what set me going. Not to write about Assange, but that particular thought.
And we'll get to 1975 in a second. But I read that your editor, Sonny Mehta, had also proposed, I don't know how seriously, that you write Assange's autobiography for him?
Yeah, I didn't know how seriously either at the time because I thought we were having lunch. We've known each other for 30 or 40 years. It was a conversation. And I talked about Assange on the issue quite passionately. And he said, well, would you like to write about Assange? And I sort of thought he was joking. And I didn't think it was a very good idea. I mean, if you're Assange, if you're the victim of a biography, everything you're doing is trying to have control. And if you're a novelist, as you know, you want to be in control all the time. It didn't seem within my skill set. And it wasn't what I wanted to do, in fact.
There is a lot of technology in it about this hack.
Mm.
Did you just sort of decide, I'll get it close to right, or did you do scrupulous research to get it right?
Well, I can't stand criticism, and I hate criticism I can prevent. And I also think that fiction does get richer and does get better if you really say what would have really happened. And you go to the expert and you say, I am determined that this will happen. Can you help me find a way in which it could happen? And so your critics then become your collaborators and we get to a richer truth.
And so, for instance, and this is not much of a spoiler alert because you find this out in the first few pages, this hack, among other things, opens up a bunch of prisons through their hacked computer systems all over the world, really. That's possible? Somebody told you that could happen?
Well, it certainly had been done. It had been done in prisons in Britain, and I did discover that the people who control the sort of software of prison security are international corporations, and so it seems quite likely. I don't think there's a precedent for something like this spreading through the world.
Right.
That's my fantasy, if you like.
Yeah, but a plausible fantasy.
A plausible one, yeah.
The book is also centrally about the history of U.S.-Australian relations. The amnesia of the title refers to Australians' forgetfulness about being bullied again and again by America. And, of course, the details of this bullying are really something I don't think most Americans know anything about. But you go back to 1975 when the CIA maybe helped nudge out an Australian government and nudge in a different one that was more friendly to America?
Well, I would say it was way more brutal than that. There was a massive lot of misinformation and bullying and freezing of money and carrots and sticks and so on.
So you start with this incredibly timely topic of government surveillance and politically motivated hacking. At what point do you decide, and I'm also going to bolt it to this somewhat obscure, interesting, but to American readers, certainly somewhat obscure Australian history?
Well, that's the Australian history is what I begin with. And there is a long part in Australia's colonial cultural history where we grew up thinking that nothing we ever did was interesting somewhere else. We grew up, and this might go right back to the penal colony, and all sorts of things, of basically feeling we were probably second rate and we were unimportant.
Because the English made you feel that way.
Absolutely.
That wasn't our doing.
No. Your turn was coming later. yes, but Australia is still a country where the history has been denied, hidden a lot, and it's easy to discover new things. I mean, if you look at Australian history and you say, well, you have a penal colony, they've been cast out, they've been traumatized, they've been sent to the moon, and they think they're going to die. So that's sort of the first, we have a convict culture at the beginning. They're victims, of course, but they also become murderers, and they become part of a serious war against the indigenous people. So we've got that to deal with, and we've got the business to deal with of the stealing of the land. So all of these things in what's still a relatively thin culture with not an army of novelists gives us a lot of things to think about.
You worked in your 20s in advertising very successfully, but writing a lot of fiction, several novels, stories on the side, and almost none of it got published. That would be enough to convince anybody like, maybe I'm not cut out for this.
Well, it was 10 years. And let's say in those 10 years, something always happened with everything I did that gave me encouragement. Like I got a little bit of it published. I got a short story. Somebody said they would publish my novel. And it took a while before they reneged on that. But even through that period.
You're a very glass half full guy. So finally, you have a book of stories come out. It's a success, but you stay in advertising. Your second book of stories comes out. Then your first two novels do well, and still you stick with advertising. And then in 1988, Oscar and Lucinda wins the Booker Prize. Is it only because of that that you finally decided, okay, I'm 45, I got the Booker, I can give up the day job?
It was soon after that. I got a serious bump in sales. And like any writer in mid-career who gets a bump in sales, you think, oh, this is the future now. My life has changed, and this is who I am now. Well, of course, it isn't. You don't know that, in fact, you're like every other writer in the world. Your sales will go up, and your sales will go down, and you'll get great reviews and bad reviews, and sometimes. So it didn't quite turn out the way I expected. So in other words, I've had a day job in New York teaching one night a week in an MFA course since I got here.
A day job teaching one night a week. You run the Hunter College MFA program.
I do.
You said that when you're writing a novel, you often reach a point where you decide, oh, this is just fatally wrong. I've got to go start again. And you go back to the beginning. Does that, A, does that always happen? And B, what does start again mean? Not you throw away everything and start with blank pages, does it?
It means different things at different times. I mean, I think everybody who writes understands that sort of feeling, like getting into something where they're worried that they're bullshitting in some way.
Yes.
And students bring those things to class. They just wanted to workshop it. And I always say, when you hear the bullshit detector ringing, just trust it because it's true. You know, and that happens to all of us, I believe. We get to a stage where things are not working. So the reasons that I'll think, well, what have I done wrong? What have I not imagined? What have I not thought? And sometimes that might mean that I start the book at a completely different place. Sometimes it means I think I know what the book's about, but I don't really know what the book's about. And I've got to think a little bit more about that so it's anchored.
But it's more than just, I got to fiddle here and fiddle there.
I fiddle all day long, but yeah. You know, it's the deck chair and the Titanic joke, I think. You've got to go back to the beginning and rebuild the ship.
And when you write historical novels or a novel, and I don't call Amnesia an historical novel, but it is filled with historical stuff, and the technology is highly researched, do you have to have a special stage of cutting away the overburdening of this manuscript with all this fascinating research that perhaps to a reader isn't as fascinating as you imagined?
I would like to think that I was very good at that at the beginning, and I would like to think that one only used what served the story. And if it's a tiny detail from 30 pages of reading, then that's quite how it should be. But inevitably, you're right. Things sometimes do get bogged down. But I think the greatest cutting and the greatest bogging down that goes on is just simply at the level of making a sentence as economical as one can make it. And there's a lot of pleasure, of course, to just going through what you can do at the end of the day. You can even do it with a glass of wine.
That's right, isn't it? Do you find that you can write at 10:30 in the morning, but not so much at 2:30 in the afternoon, but the surgery, the hacking away can be done, as you say, in the evening.
And it's pleasant. It's really pleasant to do.
Well, it's almost evening, so I'll let you go home and edit whatever you're working on.
Thank you.
Peter Carey, it has been a pleasure.
Thanks, Kit.
Peter Carey's new novel is called Amnesia. We talked for almost an hour, and you can hear our full conversation at studio360.org. Still ahead today in Studio 360? Are we depriving our children and ourselves of a crucial piece of life experience?
Boredom.
I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old who, the minute they get a sense of feeling bored, want my phone.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Boredom.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. For a show mostly about art and entertainment, I know we talk a lot about science. One reason is because we're dead set on trying to figure out how creativity works. There's some new research suggesting that if you want to be more creative, you may need to let yourself be unstimulated, unengaged. WNYC's Manoush Zomorodi is the host of the podcast New Tech City, and she has undertaken a project all about the intersection of boredom and creativity, which to me is not a bit boring.
So the way I started thinking about it was I suddenly realized, you know, I haven't really been bored in like 7 years. That was when I first got a smartphone.
Right.
And I sort of started, you know, thinking when I'm on the subway, I look at my phone. When I walk down the street, I look at my phone. Is that bad? Is there a consequence to not having that time when you literally are getting bored? So I sort of started snooping around, talking to scientists, and discovering what they call the default mode, which is a network in your brain. This was a term coined by Marcus Reichel in 2001. And they can now see that network in your brain on fMRIs that gets activated when you get bored, when your body is not being stimulated in a way physically, but your brain is supposedly idle, it's actually not idle.
And by the way, we didn't used to call it bored in the pre-smartphone day. We just called it walking around thinking, whatever, daydreaming, right? I mean, boredom, of course, makes it sound pejorative.
Negative. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And that, you know, there's semantics to it, right? Because on the one hand, you say bored and you think melancholy and depressed.
And soul-crushing job that I don't like going to.
And you know what? The researchers say actually most people who call themselves bored are indeed on the depressive side.
Uh-huh.
But
yeah.
Other people like Jerome L. Singer, psychologist, renowned psychologist, coined the term the positive constructive daydreaming.
Right.
And that's
right.
When your brain gets bored and you start to do things like problem solve.
Yes.
And have original thinking and do something called autobiographical planning, where
yes.
You make sense of all the things that are happening to you in your life and you set your goals and you figure out ways of getting to those goals.
It completely makes just intuitive, anecdotal sense to me when I'm at the gym, when I rarely am at the gym, or just walking around or whatever, taking a shower. That's when, if I ever have a good idea, that's when the good idea happens.
And Kurt, presumably, I mean, you're Kurt Anderson, so you have trained that muscle to, like, happen, right? But what about kids who haven't
right.
trained that muscle,
right.
who are looking at their phone all the time? So I sort of wanted to talk to some of the scientists about what is happening when our minds get bored? So one of the people that I spoke to is Johnny Smallwood. He is a neuroscientist in the UK, and he studies exactly that, something that is called mind wandering.
If you wanted to build a robot, for example, your simple idea might be that, well, actually, when the robot's finished doing its actions and its tasks, if you like, then what it would do is just sort of go into sort of like a standby mode where it would conserve energy. And it seems like that's definitely not what the brain does. Because when we ask people to lie in the scanner and just sort of like look at a fixation cross, for example, what the brain does is exhibit very organized spontaneous activity. And we don't really understand why it's doing that. And we believe that it's somehow related to this experiential correlate, which is when you're given nothing to do, it certainly seems that your thoughts don't stop. They continue to generate, you continue to generate thought even when you're sort of like when there's nothing for you to do with the thoughts, if that makes sense.
And so this default state is what we all experience when we're just walking around not looking at our phones?
When we allow ourselves to go there. But I think what they're saying is there's different measures of this, right? And so this took me – I wanted to know, like, well, just how bored do you really have to be? So – this brought me to actually another scientist, a psychologist, Dr. Sandy Mann, who's at the University of Central Lancashire. She did a test to try and see when do the most creative ideas come out? What has to happen? She took a group. She tried to think of the most boring task she could possibly give them. And she had them copy the phone book for 20 minutes. And then she gave
them – they still have phone books in England, I guess.
Some people. And then she gave them two cups. And she said, you know, come up with as many ideas as you possibly can for these two cups.
Uh-huh.
And they came up with ideas like use it as a planter or put special liquids into it. They kind of came up with ideas that made sense for
uh-huh.
a cup. Then she had another group just read the phone book for 20 minutes. They got really, really bored. And that is when the divergent thinking started. And they came up with earrings and a phone and musical instruments and a Madonna cone bra. So to her, it sort of showed you got to get pretty bored, and that's when the magic happens.
Now, I know you have a couple of kids. I do too, but mine are adults, so my work is done. But I do remember when I was a child, and of course, childhood itself, in retrospect to me, and at the time, had these long swaths of boredom.
Oh, yes.
And but now my memories of childhood are made up. There's this whole sensory set of memories that were boredom, but they're rich memories. And you wonder, like, has that become obsolete for Western humans?
I worry about that immensely. I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old who, the minute they get a sense of feeling bored, want my phone. And I'm ashamed to say, very often hand it over because I think American adults have lost the ability to listen to belly aching. If you're on an airplane and your kid is complaining, the dirty looks you get around you saying, hand the kid a phone, for goodness sake, you know?
Yeah.
But there is that. I remember my parents just being like, tough luck, you're bored. There's a very vivid memory I have. 8 years old, I went around the entire house and collected all the houseplants, set them up, put name tags on all of them, and then made a concert for them. I don't think my kids
would do that.
Absolutely no good reason. But
I think there's an app where you can do that.
Yeah, right? And we joke about it, but we kind of do everything on our phones now. One of the people I spoke to is Alex Peng. He's written a book called The Distraction Addiction. And he actually went and talked with some Buddhist monks who are on the internet, on social media. But they saw this addiction thing really differently.
What they always came back with was, all right, why is it that you think that technologies are any more distracting than your own mind or anything else in the world? Distraction, they said, is an internal problem. Distraction comes from within. It comes from craving. It comes from all the various other sort of ailments that Buddhism seeks to address.
That sounds exactly right. And maybe it doesn't require the discipline of Buddhist monkdom, but it sounds like it's applicable and actionable for all of us maybe.
Yeah, and I hope that, you know, this idea of mindfulness has really become mainstream.
Yeah.
Why can't this idea of using your technology thoughtfully also become mainstream?
Absolutely. So on your podcast, New Tech City, you've decided to try to both measure and do something about what you see as this general threat to creativity that our cell phones pose.
There's no proof there that there are indeed science, you know, they can't show the causality of looking at smartphones disrupting our creativity. But that is the hypothesis. So we decided to come up with this idea of Bored and Brilliant, the project that we're working on, to give people a chance to see what it is like when they decide to take control of their phone habits. Does it trigger or trip any creativity in them?
And ironically, again, it involves an app.
Well, because nothing these days doesn't, right? So what we've done is we have partnered with an app that's called Moment. And it not only does it measure how much time you spend on your phone, but it measures how many times you pick it up just to check it.
Really? So it knows that. You put this app on your phone and all the time it's saying, another time.
Yep.
So how is this all going to work as a project?
The very first week of February, we have a week of challenges. Every day, someone will get a challenge. So, for example, the very first day is called Put It in Your Pocket. When you are in transit, you are not to look at your phone. Your phone is not going to be there. And then as we go through the week, we're going to start giving them assignments to sort of help them be creative in some way. We're going to ask them to get bored and then complete an assignment.
And seeing if there's a reward for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be. That's our hypothesis.
Good. You're doing God's work. Manoush, thanks very much.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And come back and tell us how it all works out.
Oh, I will. Are you going to do it, Kurt?
I'll maybe. Sure.
Don't be scared. Come on.
No. Yes, I will do it. I promise.
Okay. Oh, please put the phone down.
Oh, please put the phone down. Manoush Zomorodi is the host of the podcast New Tech City. You can find out more about this project, Bored and Brilliant, at studio360.org and find out how you can take part. Oh, please put the phone down. As you probably know, we often ask listeners and artists about works of art that changed their lives. Today, Sandra Bernhardt. If you've ever heard her sing or seen her act, you really can't forget her. She's almost cartoonishly tough and irreverent, but also intensely sincere. Her breakout role came 30 years ago when Martin Scorsese cast her as an obsessed young fan who kidnaps a talk show host in The King of Comedy.
Do you like these glasses? Crystal, beautiful. I bought them just for you. I don't know, there's something about them that remind me of just the simplicity of them. But if you don't like them, if there's even an inkling, even a doubt in your mind...
Sandra Bernhardt in real life had her own obsession with a famous performer, a non-pathological obsession. In 1963, she saw a touring production of Hello, Dolly, starring Carol Channing. Bernhardt was 8 years old.
You know, and then we got to the theater and we sat in our seats and just, like, you know, the electrifying atmosphere of the Fisher Theater was just overwhelming. And, of course, then the band, you know, the orchestra strikes up, the overture, and you're ready to jump out of your skin. And then out walks this creature, Carol Channing, in full, you know, 1890s regalia with the headdress and the hat and the, you know, the corseted dress.
Hello, Harry. Well, hello, Louis. It's so nice to be back home where I belong.
And I was just jumping out of my seat. I mean, I was near hysteria. She had this voice that, you know, was unparalleled by anybody else. It was very enchanting. I mean, that's, of course, what made her such a big star and separated her from the pack.
Going strong, I feel the room swaying, for the band's playing one of my old favorite songs from way back when. So bridge that gap, fellas, find me an empty lap, fellas. Dolly'll never go away again.
And all the waiters were, you know, dancing. Right from the get-go, I assumed that I should be a part of the cast. Why am I not on stage here, playing one of the, at least one of the supporting roles? It was just the whole experience of being in the theater and being with people that I felt were my kindred spirits, you know, that I felt I was home and where I belonged with these bigger-than-life characters. So when I saw it, you know, actually come to life on a stage with, you know, with an orchestra and sets, I was like, okay, well, I could bump it up to that easily.
Get the old girl now, fellas.
Well, one of the first times I ever came to New York, I made this sort of strange bet with myself. I said, if you see Carol Channing on this trip, that means you're going to be successful in your career. So this was probably in the 70s. And I actually did see Carol Channing crossing 57th and Madison. She was walking in front of me. And it was total kismet. I didn't bother her at the time. I hadn't really made my mark yet.
Happy together. Unhappy together.
Carol was a jumping-off place for me. She definitely gave me that license to say, you can just go for broke. I always felt like it was, you know, not only my gift, but it was my responsibility, and still is when people come to see me, to take it all the way out there, like, you know, like Carol would.
We're in and we're out of the money.
I definitely think my performance in The King of Comedy, when I played Masha.
Let's do something crazy tonight. Just get insane. I want to be crazy.
Who was slightly unhinged, was, you know, a direct descendant of Carol's performance.
Carol, I'll have a good time. You can't get crazy. See,
this character was insane and had to really just go completely crazy.
Wouldn't you like to see me out of my head? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be fabulous?
And my, you know, exposure to Carol early on gave me the license to do it. And then I think the first time I actually met her is when she came backstage to see me perform when I was doing my show I'm Still Here, Damn It, in 1997. And she came backstage, she was wearing all white. She let her hair go natural. She wasn't wearing wigs anymore. She looked amazing, fit as a fiddle. And she literally came back, took me into her arms and said, you are my spiritual granddaughter. So I knew that I had really, you know, come full circle to be, you know, blessed by Carol Channing.
Sandra Bernhard's story was produced by Michael Raphael. And by the way, Carol Channing turns 94 next weekend. Was there some play or movie or sonata or video game or any cultural thing that altered the course of your life? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org and we might put you on the radio. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening. And one final thing. If you're going to be in or around New York City the last week in January, you're invited to join us at one of the world premiere performances of Mike Doty's rock musical Revelation at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space. We have just added a third performance, so there are still a few tickets left. And if you can't make it in person, we'll be live streaming the shows online. Information and tickets are on our website, studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoek.
Thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
A century ago, Native Americans had pretty much one escape from the dreariness of reservation life, joining Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show. They got to see the world, but they also had to play Indian for white audiences.
They expect me to be a chief, so I have to present myself stoic or whatever they're looking for. I give them all that.
The legacy of Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.